Welcome to the CG Pro podcast. This is episode 55 with Andy Crocker. If you enjoy what you hear today, you can follow us at becomecgpro.com and in our Facebook group. So yeah, today it gives me great pleasure. I've been looking forward to this one. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Andy Crocker to the show. Andy is a prolific career in computer graphics. He's been all kinds of things in all sorts of different industries, and most notably recently was senior vice president running the studio at the MSG Sphere, and is now the founder of the AV Club. Andy, welcome. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me. Really, really happy to be here today.
Happy you're here. So I always love to kick this off just asking you a little bit about how you got here. What especially, if anything, inspired you in your kind of early days as a kid or in your young life, if there was anything particular that inspired you to want to go down this crazy road of computer graphics and film and interactive media?
This winding road. I can kind of describe the short version of my very meandering journey to where I am today, which is, when I was a little kid, we got a video camera when I was probably 8, and just loved using it. Loved, shooting stuff, little stop motions, and weird stuff. And at some point, decided want to be a movie director. So went to film school. I went to USC and studied production. And just like most people that go to film school, I graduated and said, "Okay, cool. So I'm a movie director now, right?" And then realized that that's not how it works, and had to kind of find my way. And I somewhat randomly ended up working in not just post-production, but visual effects. Started a runner at a visual effects company called Asylum, and learned VFX, and a decade later suddenly realized that visual effects, if you want to be a movie director, visual effects is actually a pretty bad choice, because there's not a lot of interface when you're working, especially in movies. You don't interface with the directors and the producers and the writers. You do when you hit the supervisor level, but as an artist, that's not really sort of a stepping stone to directing. And so I kind of had a crisis. A life crisis a little bit, right as visual effects was starting to really wobble for the first time, which was right around 2012, when VFX Soldier was going nuts and Rhythm and Hues collapsed, and just things had been shaky for a couple years, but that's when it really started shaking. And I was at a company called Murata, which had started out as motion graphics and visual effects, but then had sort of slapped the word transmedia on the front door. And that meant that we got a lot of projects that were not music video, commercial, film, or TV. There were installations, apps, just weird stuff. And my hobby from graduating college up until that time had been doing really weird high-tech improv, where the AV Club came from originally. We were an improv comedy troupe in LA. And so I had my day job working in visual effects, and my nights and weekends and any time I possibly could find doing initially live shows, but then eventually we started doing a lot of early web video. And so it all around 2012 kind of came together at a head at Murata, where they needed people in-house that had done something non-traditional. And so, we were a YouTube partner, and I'd done a bunch of sort of website web development and stuff for the AV Club, and so I was like, all right, yeah, I can do that. And I slowly transitioned into less and less visual effects and motion graphics, and more VR and apps and installations and projection mapping and all kinds of weird stuff. And then that is kind of where I am now, is this weird technical creative guy that I know how to do all the traditional stuff, both live action and post, but then I love weird tech. So the dude, you know, have sort of fingers in a lot of pies. I've got, you know, I'm right now, literally in my office right now, finishing up a VR app for a short film that I did. And meanwhile, also working on some Stable Diffusion stuff and some nerfs and, you know, just a little bit of the, everything right now. So that's the meandering journey that got me to where I am today.
A really interesting journey, and I guess you're in the perfect time for you right now, because there's so much weird stuff, as you say, emerging at the moment. I've never known a time like this, so there's been this much, you know. I kind of just missed all of the like huge leaps in computer graphics. There was obviously incremental improvements, but now we're seeing just things just very, it's an overused word, but very disruptive time. Yeah. In the tech side. So you must be enjoying it right now.
There's a lot of uncertainty and yeah, doubt and fear in, you know, just in the industry as a whole. I would say in society as a whole, honestly. I don't think it's just entertainment that's having issues, but I am personally very excited and very invigorated, but I don't have any answers. So there's uncertainty. I don't have any fear, but I have a ton of uncertainty, and I don't have any doubt either. I know that we're going to discover sort of new mediums and new forms of entertainment and even just, you know, new genres and new ways of creating things. But I think right now it's not very clear. It's very murky sort of what that's going to be. We have a lot of we're not in a death spiral, but we're in a stall, I think, the entertainment industry right now, where the things that have been working for some of them a century, some of them decades, are not working as well. And so there's kind of this kind of chaos right now. And I'm excited because, you know, the things that I like doing, I think, are the path forward, you know, the path out of this. And so it's tons of opportunity right now. If you're not trying to sort of, you know, breathe a few more years of life into something that's maybe not working.
Yeah, it's really, I'm glad you brought that up, because it's obviously going on. There's obviously a lot of challenges in the film, media and entertainment sector in general, but particularly in film because of the strikes. And that relates to a number of different things, including AI, more so the platforms, really, because what I think people didn't necessarily know or see is going on is that tech companies kind of bought the film industry and created something that we're now living with. And here we are.
And I think the, you know, AI is one of the things I'm interested in right now. I'm interested in it as a tool. And I think a lot of the fear and anger, you know, definitely a lot of anger right now in our industry around AI, it misses the point to a certain degree. And even a lot of the discussions about the strikes that are happening right now, the writers and the actors, they miss the point because they don't address the core problem. The core problem, like you said, is the tech companies changed the process of making film and TV in particular, but they didn't just change the process, they devalued the product. So it now costs more money to make a feature film than you can realistically expect to recoup across an entire slate. Any one movie, maybe, but the market can't support dozens of $100 million+ movies. There's not enough people willing to pay as much at the box office as it costs to support that. And we all have these buffet, all you can eat Netflix and everything plans. And so the problem right now is that the product is broken. And so when you talk about AI and replacing jobs and everything like that, yes, some jobs will be replaced, you know, especially the less creative roles like roto and, you know, paint and cleanup and tracking. Those are definitely going to be very challenged by AI. But if sort of pinning the blame on AI right now is not putting the blame where it belongs and putting the pressure where it needs to be, which is on the studio heads, especially at, you know, Apple and Amazon and Netflix, to fix what they broke, which was they turned it into a thing where, you know, how much is a movie worth? $12 a month. That's not how much a movie is worth. That's how much a buffet costs. But, you know, a movie is a plate. And if you want an all-you-can-eat buffet, you're not willing to pay anything for a single plate. And until that's been fixed, residuals, number of writers in a writer's room, digital likenesses, use of AI tools, all of that is secondary because it doesn't matter. Those are efficiencies. Those are cost reduction measures. Those are ways to, you know, either lower costs or, you know, maintain costs and increase quality or quantity, more like. So, you know, I think we all need to kind of, you know, it's not coming back. You know, movies and TVs have peaked and they're never coming back, or we need a real deep fundamental pivot, you know, at the studio network level to address the real problem, which is nobody's willing to pay for the product anymore, at least not what it costs to make it.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing too, because a lot of people, I don't think, are aware of the back end for the studios too, which they created the issue, essentially.
Yeah.
But they are dealing with big debts, and not the, I think everyone's looking at them as having huge piles of cash that they just need to redistribute properly. They don't have that, as far as I know, anyway. So it's not. Yeah, it's a really interesting thing to open up, because. And I like how you've described it as being that we're looking, not that we shouldn't be looking into the moral and ethics of AI, but putting it all on that, you know, in terms of why we're striking or why there's problems in the film industry isn't, as you said, isn't a balanced perspective. And I think it's going to be. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on, like, how can we fix the problem, Andy?
All right. Here's my first hot take. This will piss some people off. We need to get rid of residuals. Contractually, we can't get rid of residuals that exist, but we need to stop residuals moving forward. And here's why. When an actor says, you know, hey, I received a $26 check, you know, from a thing I did 5 years ago. Cool. The accounting firm that processed that payment made way more than $26 residual. So the residual system, the way that movies and TV shows are right now, every project, every film, every TV show is its own LLC with its own accounting encapsulated within it. It takes an army of accountants to process all of the income coming in from licensing agreements and, yes, syndication, et cetera, if it's a TV show, and turn those into residual checks. So we've created a military industrial complex of accounting that is taking all the profit from everyone and it's just going into, you know, accounting firm pockets. And then, yes, also intentionally labyrinthine, money processing that benefits the studios and massively does not benefit the talent. So what about equity? Why don't we, I'm not saying make every studio a public company. You can have shares in it. You can have equity in a private company. If you work at Apple today and you work on some new product and it does really well, you do not get paid residuals on the product that you made. You get value in the equity that you have in the company, the shares that you have, either that you bought yourself or that were, you know, granted to you. So what if production companies and studios gave equity instead of back-end points? So instead of residuals, you either get, you know, most people don't actually get residuals. That's another thing. You know, residuals is primarily for actors and above the line talent. So when we talk about residuals, we're not talking about the entire industry as a whole, but
definitely not visual effects.
God, no. Yeah, not even a little bit in visual effects. So if you change the residual model fundamentally to be a lot more like what we've had for over a century, where you either can, you know, buy some equity in a company, as you know, you can buy shares. That's a thing you can do, and then benefit in the value increasing of, you know, as the slate grows, or be granted them as back end points, you know, just like you would working in any company anywhere in the world. You know, so it's like the entertainment industry replaced a perfectly functioning equity sharing model with a intentionally deceptive black box of, you know, of residuals that primarily benefit the studios and the accounting firms. So let's get rid of them. You change that. I don't think it'll fix everything, but it'll shift things pretty significantly, very quickly. It'll make the accounting a lot more transparent and easy, because instead of every episode and every TV show and every film in your library having its own accounting, its own books that either, you know, to be cooked, or if you're an honest company, you know, to just be reconciled, you go to a company with products and a library, you know, with assets. So I think that will never happen, because it relies on the studios and networks to fundamentally change the way they're operating. There is a chance that Apple and Amazon, that are not entertainment companies, they're consumer electronics and a shipping and distribution company, potentially they could shift it, where instead of adopting Hollywood practices and becoming part of Hollywood the way they have, they could actually push back and treat entertainment the way they treat, you know, their core businesses. That might push a shift. You know, that might be a big enough crowbar to sort of end the way the studios have built, you know, the finances. Will that solve everything? Probably not. will it maybe, you know, pull out of some of the nosedives that they're in? Hopefully.
Right. Yeah. And it's just a clear up for everyone. You're not saying necessarily take people's residuals away. It's just change it, make it be what it should be, written, essentially.
Yeah. No new residuals, basically. So, you know, you can't get rid of people's residuals as they exist, but it, you know, them out. Just no more new residuals. Switch to an equity model, and then just age out the residuals that exist. You know, and it'll never happen. So. That's one way to fix it that just won't be done, but it addresses a lot of the fundamental problem, which is really it's money, it's the distribution of money.
Right. Yeah. And we've gone from, I think, while it's sort of obvious if you state it, we've gone from a one model where it was actual studios running the show, and now it's tech companies who wanted to get into that business and were somewhat successful, but created a kind of lost leader, essentially, to grow an audience. And now we're dealing with that. But maybe if they're new enough to the game, maybe they won't mind having to go a different way. Who knows? It's a tricky problem, though. I think not everybody understands.
It's a tricky problem. I know Zendaya has a production company that's been experimenting with sort of profit sharing versus residuals.
Interesting.
It implodes a... Sorry. I don't know if you can... It says my connection is bad. Hope I'm back.
You can hear you. You only dropped for a second there.
Okay, good. I'm doubtful, because it requires powerful people to cede some of their power, and it requires studios that have built a many decades long tradition of secrecy to sort of step into the light with their accounting. And, you know, I don't have a lot of hope that it will be voluntary, but it's one way out. It's one way out. And I certainly think looking forward at, what's next, what's after movies and what's after TV shows in terms of new forms of entertainment, my hope would be that those would be sort of grown from the up versus initiatives of the power players, the studios and networks primarily. So we'll see.
Right.
We'll see. I'm not pessimistic, but I'm pretty realistic. You know, people don't like giving up power. So
that's true. Yeah, definitely a lot of upset, a lot of change. And I think with change, there's inevitably upset. We're in that right now. We're looking. People are looking for answers. People are scared. People are, looking to a thing to give them their livelihood, which has really shifted. I'm optimistic as well. I'm hopeful. I think what this all comes back to, though, is whatever medium we use, whatever distribution network we use, is storytelling. And ultimately, that's way older than any of these things. We've been doing it for a very long time, and people want to keep doing it. And that's what gives me optimism that we'll find a way. Because it's very, very desirable.
And I'm personally very excited about the time we're in right now, because we have a, I don't know if it's once in a lifetime, but it's certainly very rare opportunity. There's a David and Goliath moment possible right now, or actually many David and Goliath moments possible. AI, yes. But it's not just AI. It's, you look at sort of the social media platforms, TikTok in particular, but YouTube has been right there, first and foremost for a while. There is huge opportunity right now for people to create whatever they want to create and distribute it either completely for free or almost for free. On a level that has been impossible, and that is leading to a lot of really interesting work that's happening right now. The thing that's not happening is monetization of that. There's very few people making a full career of the weird stuff, the fringe, the new, the emerging. It's coming. It's inevitable. It's progress. But, I think there has never been a time, I went to film school. I started film school in the late 90s, after the amazing surge of indie film in the 90s, so everyone in film school was very sort of hopeful that we would be kind of stepping out of film school into an industry, just like Clerks and Six Lies and Videotape and, all the great indie films that built, huge careers. And that didn't really materialize. We were at the end of that wave a little bit. And then, the YouTube wave, I personally fell into a gap. I was too young for the indie film wave and too old for the sort of YouTube creator wave. I was a few years late and a few years too early. I was in this little gap. And definitely a lot of filmmakers that are huge, top tier, Soderbergh, et cetera, folks today rode that indie wave in the 90s. And there are definitely the Mr. Beasts of the world, just absolutely crushing it and cleaning up, in terms of web video. I think we're in another one of those moments right now where you've got Blender is free. You've got all these AI tools are effectively free. There isn't really anything you need. Soderbergh is shooting major Hollywood movies on an iPhone right now. there's no sort of, you know, like if I can just convince, you know, my friends and family to give me $35,000, I'll have enough to make my short film and, you know, and get noticed and et cetera. It's like, no, you've got your phone, you've got a computer, you know, just make it. There's never been less excuse than there is right now.
Yeah, right. It's more accessible than ever. Like you mentioned, the people getting access to cheaper cameras gave them the ability to make film, but it didn't give them the ability to maybe some practical effects if they're clever, but not really visual effects. That was like only in ILM, and then after that, only if you had $500,000 for a SGI machine, and slowly got $50,000 for Maya, and it slowly got cheaper and cheaper. But now, as you said, we've got the tools to be able to do. It's made visual effects accessible. You need this knowledge and some skill, but you now anybody can now do anything that's in their imagination.
Have you? There was a Wired article that defined it. I don't know how much of a widely used term it is. Have you heard of weird CG? Is that something you've crossed? So I'm pretty sure it was Wired. I wrote an article. Everyone has now. It was an article. I believe it was Wired. It was called like The Rise of Weird CG. It was years ago, maybe 4 years ago that they wrote it. And it was exactly about that, which was the cost tools has come down so much that now people, you know, CG artists in particular, on Instagram back then, and, you know, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, even Twitch now, they're doing things that don't have any financial incentive to make them. And they're just weird. They're just ideas. They're doodles. You know, they're ideas that would have been so prohibitively expensive that they never would have been made, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, because they're not, you won't get a return on the investment it'll cost in software and you know, artist time to make them. And that has now, the AI tools, the thing that I'm kind of really, when I see them, I'm like, this is the exciting stuff. It's not the people that are trying to make high end or replace high end professional content, you know, whatever, you know, short films or music videos. It's the people that are using them to do like the Will Smith eating spaghetti, just the weird stuff that, you know, a CG animation of Will Smith eating spaghetti would take either one person years to model and, you know, rig and animate and do the Sims and, you know, everything. But now that's, you know, it's a text prompt away. And it's like, is that the future? Is that going to replace movies and TV shows? No, that's not. But it is something that would never exist otherwise, and it's funny as heck, and it is a different kind of thing. It's not going to replace movies, but it is something that wouldn't exist otherwise. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm really interested in and excited in. It's just the really weird AI, weird CG. Now that kids are learning Blender, it's like we're starting to see, you know, we're starting to see inside in, you know, people's brains that would have never had access to, you know, to either create the just silly ideas that they're having or tell the stories. You know, there's also, we are seeing some interesting stuff happening as well.
Having worked in visual effects and in big studios and doing weird CG as well, if you were like starting out today in your career, what kinds of things do you think, what kinds of things would you learn? What advice would you have to somebody? It's very different than it was when I got into this.
Yeah. I got into VFX in 21 years ago. So, it was very, very, very different. And it was a transition from Inferno to Flame, you know, from $1 million box to a $250,000 box. You know, Maya was $10,000-$15,000 a seat. It was still kind of like a a dark art. You had to be at a facility with, you know, yep. with a lot of people to learn anything, like just to get one foot in the door. Now, you know, it's don't spend a penny on anything, on hardware and software, you know, like just get Blender. Resolve is free, you know, the non-studio version. Get Resolve, it's got Fusion built into it. You know, skip the $600 a year for Adobe, skip the thousands for Nuke. You know, like you don't need any of that stuff starting out, but you will discover things that you want or need along the way. And then just buy those things, you know, just get those plugins, just invest in that software. But it's not, you know, we're in this weird transition time. So it's not a really good time to follow a prescribed path that has worked for somebody else. Like it's really just figure out how it all works. You know, I think is kind of the most important lesson right now. And that's, I jokingly have always said that my main job skill is Google, and it's been pretty true. It, you know, it's as the AI stuff started spiking a year ago, you know, it was like, I'm still really into Nerfs and now Gaussian splatting, but nobody taught it to me. You know, I just cracked Google and just cracked it open and just started Googling and following, you know, threads and just be like, what is a Nerf? You know, who makes Nerfs? How do you make a Nerf? You know, and just learn how the things that interest you work, you know, and don't worry too much about tutorials. Don't worry about, you know, sort of career advice, because what worked for me, it barely worked for me, and it certainly isn't going to work for anyone else. And, you know, it certainly was not a plan. You know, if I had a plan, it was to be a movie director by now. So, you know, clearly don't follow my plan.
You kind of are.
Yeah, but that crisis I had in 2012 was actually, it wasn't a bad crisis. It wasn't a, you know, dark hour of the soul, you know, meltdown. It was a deep like relief that it was not a giving up on my dream. It was a realization that my dream of being a, you know, Hollywood movie director, it's not that it wasn't attainable. It was that it isn't what I have wanted to be. It is, you know, a Hollywood movie director is a CEO of, you know, of a product company with nightmare studio, you know, executives to deal with and just problems in every direction. You know, it's not even working for the people it's working for. And that was the realization in 2012, was not that I wasn't going to make it and therefore I needed a new dream. It was, I could make it. I could push. I was at Guillermo del Toro's company. I absolutely could have, you know, done something to try to make a move, you know. And it was more realization that I didn't want that job anymore because the job had changed while I was trying to get it, but, you know, work my way towards it. And I needed a new goal. And VR came out a year later, basically, the Oculus dev kit. And I just, you know, put on the DK1 and was just, I saw not my career, but I saw the medium of VR, like, you know, just, you know, in 10 seconds, I saw work go. You know, live action and VFX and real time. I was just like, this is everything. This is all the stuff. This is all my hobbies and all of my, you know, all the pieces of my career. This is absolutely filmmaking. This is absolutely visual effects. This is absolutely games, interactive, improv, theater. You know, like this is all of the things I love. And I've kind of, I didn't pivot out of VR, but I expanded out of VR. So it was that realization of like, oh, all of the weird stuff that I do on the side, plus my day job, all comes together in this space. Oh, weird. It also applies to AR. Oh, huh. It also applies to live events and domes. And so it was less of a pivot and or, you know, course correction, and more of just kind of a realization of these weird pieces actually fit together cohesively. And it wasn't directing movies for Hollywood. It was making immersive and interactive entertainment.
Yeah, I love what you're saying there. There's a lot to unpack, but the one thread that I'm unpacking is that you can't really, and this was true for me too, you can't really necessarily guess where the exact seat you're going to be sitting on, even though you think you might. Like, I wanted to be an animator because I saw Jurassic Park. I wanted to be an animator, and then I started trying animation and wasn't honest with myself for 6+ years of trying it. I actually didn't really like the process. And I'm like, no, this is not what I want to do. But I was kind of lying to myself all the way along. Yeah. And instead, when I did get honest with myself and I really listened to what I was enjoying, that's when it started getting a lot better. And yeah. What I'm unpacking from what you're saying is to be open and be curious to what life is telling you.
And the thing I wish that somebody had told me, because I could have been better at it. I feel like I was pretty good at it, but I could have been better, was there is a invisible favor economy that is strongest when you're starting out, but it's there for you as long as you want it, and you should want it your entire career, which is if somebody asks for something, or if the way it manifests now for me mostly is if I see somebody that needs something, you know, they're looking for whatever, they're looking for an animator, you know, looking for something simple or something big. And I know somebody else, or I run across somebody else that is aligned with that. I connect them, you know, just like, here, you two should talk. There's no finder's fee. There's no, I'm involved now because I introduced, you know, it is, you two can benefit each other. You should go and go do good things. And I do that as much as I can now. And when I was starting out, there was a lot of, can you help me on my film? Hey, I need a sound guy. I mean, it's never even real roles, right? It's like, I need somebody to hold a boom pole. I need somebody to, you know, help, you know, load in some equipment. Just dig in hard on the favor economy. Do as many favors as you can. Keep track, not of who you've done favors for, but who you owe, who has done favors for you. And just bend over backwards to return the favor and pay it forward, et cetera. And it just, it builds and it builds and it builds. And it gets to the point where if you need something, you can kind of just shout out into the community of just like, hey, I really need this. And, you know, if you've done it right, you've built a really compassionate and sort of, collaborative network, or, you know, around yourself and around each other.
Right. Yeah. Karma works on the internet these days, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Build it up.
Whatever you put out into the world is what comes back to you.
Yeah. And often tenfold.
Right. Yeah. I love how you're describing this. And, instead of saying to the question, what would you learn? You know, it's more of an approach, a philosophy, psychology, as opposed to a piece of software. When I started, I wanted to know what piece of software to learn.
But it's not absolutely. Quite the same now. I think the there's kind of like a I know Kung Fu moment in everybody's career, in post in particular, where you realize that the user interfaces are just the core math is the same, you know, like as a normal, you know, Maxon hasn't reinvented, you know, or they don't have different normals than Houdini. And so at some point you realize that the tools just come down to artist preference, yourself as well, where, you know, I hate Maya. I've always hated Maya. I love Blender currently. I enjoy C4D. I was a Max user for a while. I've just never Houdini as well. I've nicked Maya, and it's fine. That doesn't mean Maya's bad. It just means Maya's not for me. And there are people that do beautiful, incredible, powerful work in Maya. So it's not about what Maya can and can't do. It's about, does it work for you? And so, you know, try Blender, and if you hate it, try Houdini. And if you hate it, try C4D. And if you hate it, try Max. And if you hate it, try Maya. And if you hate it, maybe don't do 3D. Maybe do something. maybe try 2D, you know. And if you don't like Nuke, you know, try After Effects. And if you don't like After Effects, try Fusion or Silhouette. You know, it really does come down to, do you enjoy using it? I enjoy using After Effects for motion graphics. I enjoy using Resolve, you know. And so, you know, try a lot, but recognize that they're just marketing terms slapped on top of some fundamentals. Learn the fundamentals if you can, and you'll be able to jump into a new piece of software very quickly, because you really just need to know what they call it. You don't need to know, you know, actually how they work. You just need to know,
right,
how have they rebranded this. So
yeah, it's a great point, and that's what we're big on at CG Pro as the school, is the having jumped between, I've went to work at ILM and I had 3 days to do Xeno tutorials before the producer was over my shoulder going, where's the shot? It was not very long. I didn't have 3 months to go do a course. It, as you said, it's just the pixels are pixels, vertices are vertices, and this stuff is all resolving to that. And lot of ways, the user interface is kind of the thing that's, it's been helping us not have to code for every pixel that we get, but still is a thing that's an abstraction and it's kind of in the way. And now we're experiencing what we really want to do, but everybody's angry about, and rightly so in some cases, but we're trying to communicate with machines. That's what we're really trying to do. And hopefully now that's getting easier.
There's a thing in AI that I don't think has really been, there's not enough of a spotlight shining on it. ChatGPT, language models in general, but ChatGPT has changed a really fundamental sort of rule in software development, which for us in VFX and post is pipeline, which is, you know, it's a joke, but it's treated sort of like a rule, which is, you know, a programmer will spend 6 hours to automate a 30-minute task. It's like, ha, ha, ha. But that's not what ChatGPT is doing. There are many, 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 many tasks that require enough of an understanding of Bash or, you know, God forbid, PowerShell or some sort of more obscure interface that senior developers whose time is incredibly valuable could solve in 5 minutes. But the task will never get, it'll always be easier to give a junior, you know, developer, junior artist, the Mechanical Turk job of like, take these 1200 files, sort them into 80 folders, 15 at a time, rename them, and, you know, 1 through 15 or 0 through 14, and put this text file in each of those folders and repath that, right? That would take a long time. That would take hours for somebody. A senior developer could absolutely, or, you know, pipeline lead could absolutely solve that task one time, 5, 10, 15 minutes, whatever. It'll never be worth their time. ChatGPT means that whoever needs to do that task, mid-level, senior, mid-level, junior, can sort of talk back and forth to ChatGPT, go, hey, what's the syntax for this? What do I do? And, oh, it's, you know, it's not renaming them. Oh, okay, I see. You're not copying them, or you're copying, not moving, whatever. So now all of a sudden there's this whole swath of tasks in especially visual effects that normally would not have been automated that now can be automated. And that is a huge deal. It's not replacing anyone. It's automating something that never would have been automated because it's not worth it. It's a one-time thing, or, you know, it requires some very arcane sort of understanding. That's a big deal. And that's the efficiency gain on an individual level, on your own work, or at a studio level, where suddenly now people don't need a pipeline tool to be developed to do whatever needs to be done. You know, people can put a post-render script in their Maya file that'll, you know, rename stuff and move it when it's done. That's a really big freaking deal. And yeah. I think a lot of the pushback about security and ethics and all of that are drowning those kinds of really game-changing things. Nobody's going to lose a job over that, but suddenly we're going to be able to do things that never would have rated high enough to be done. And that's major. That's a big shift in the way, you know, pipelines work and studios can operate. So.
And I putting the ethics debate aside, which I do often, but the programming side's easy to talk about. It was one of those for my first career. When I was at university, we were learning binary and even more than that, like voltage changes on chips. No, that's where it really comes from. But then okay, you get assembly language, which is horrible to write. But that's where people started, right? People started writing voltage change, and then they wrote binary, then they wrote assembly language, then they get higher level languages, and they're not lamenting not having to write binary anymore because you get a higher level language. It's made it easier. Now hopefully we're making it easier, liberating, being able to talk to computers, which is what this is all about. We're trying to talk to computers. And hopefully that keeps getting easier. I've written hundreds of thousands of lines of code in my life, and to have not have to have written all of those, but still get the result, I would be great. I'd be doing other things with that time.
Yeah.
Being able to solve bigger problems. Yeah. Yeah. Being able to just focus on the creative side of it. Exactly.
Yeah. That's the part that sort of, I have a lot of, I have a lot of human empathy for the anti-AI crowd in the art side of things. But I don't have a lot of sympathy. So I understand the emotion of it because my visual effects career was constantly being revised sweat factories overseas. I was a 3D tracker in the early 2000s when 3D tracking was expensive and difficult. Now it's outsourced. I never did Roto, but if I were a Roto art, you know, I remember Roto was done in-house, you know, in LA. You know, Roto, I don't think there's any, if there are, there's very few Roto artists left, you know, in America. It's all outsourced. I did Fluid Sims when they were expensive and hard, and now they're buttons, you know, it's very easy. They're free, they're in Blender free. My career in visual effects, I just always described it as like running across a bridge that was collapsing behind me. And so I've never been comfortable. I've never been able to just kind of stand still and just do what I love. I loved tracking. I really did. I loved Fluid Sims. I really did. I wasn't grateful when it became impossible to make a career, a living doing those things. But I've always accepted that that's going to happen. And so I've always been running. And so now, you know, AI is coming nipping at the heels of a lot of people that I think felt safe. And so my empathy is I know personally how that feels. The thing that you love, the thing that you're good at, the thing that you spent time mastering is now devalued and quickly becoming something that you can't make money doing anymore. So full empathy with that. The sympathy is the world is not going to stop. You know, the march of technology is not going to stop because you feel bad. And it didn't stop for me when I lost the things that I loved, you know, repeatedly. So, you know, and even, you know, I'm really sad that Google Tango didn't work out. I loved Google Tango. I thought it was really cool. You know,
they did some cool stuff with that. Yeah.
I genuinely. We need a lot of empathy as a community for how it feels, but the sympathy can't extend to, you know, like the Inferno died. It was replaced by the Flame. The Flame is dying. It's being replaced by Nuke. Should we as an industry support the Flame artists and by basically freezing all Nuke development so that the Flame can remain dominant until they retire so that they don't have to shift to a new package? No. So by extension, a lot of the stuff that people are really, you know, freaking out about, it's either not the threat that people think it is, or if it is threatening, it's threatening, like I said, roto and tracking, and, you know, it's very good at doing objective, non-creative things. Everyone's starting to realize it's pretty terrible at subjective, creative things. It's good at helping you, but it's not, you know, it's not just going to replace you in those tasks. So just think we need, as a community, to just wrap our arms around the anti-AI crowd and just say, this is a golden opportunity to stop doing the things you don't like doing, masking in Photoshop, you know, just all the sort of, you know, like in painting, you know, and by in painting, I literally just mean just backfill behind, you know, see, add some parallax to a shot or something like that. Those are not creative tasks. And the opportunity right now is to outsource those to AI and do more of the thing that you came to this industry to do, to be creative, to create, to make art. Everyone's going to choose their own path. I don't think it's our responsibility to forcibly lift everyone up and push them into, you know, whatever the future is going to be. But I do think that we need to kind of work on, as a community, sort of the way we're dealing with this crisis of, you know, because it's not new. We've been facing outsourcing for decades, and it's just outsourcing to a computer instead of somebody in a third world country, you know?
Right. Yeah. And I it's very interesting what you're saying. No, there's a lot of that getting lumped in with all of the industry woes, of which are not to do with AI. And I think it's very interesting to talk through be real about what these things are and what they're actually doing. And I think certain things that you want to go away just because you're used to it being the way it was, that some things aren't, they're almost not possible to put back in the box. I think this is one of them. And also, I think love to, I don't know if it's not going to happen either, but the labeling of it as AI, I think is not helping it, because it implies that it's more scary than it really is.
Yeah. It's the dumbest thing I've experienced. It is the, you know, if Midjourney is a artist, it is the dumbest artist I have ever worked with in my entire career, you know, and in some ways least creative. Oh God, please. Yeah. Good luck. Yeah. No. So I think it is not intelligent. It is not thinking. It's just random, you know, and it has a lot of inputs. So, you know, it comes up with very random outputs, but I think we need to sort of figure out how, like any new technology, you know, if you're smart about new technology, you immediately try and figure out what it's not good at as much as you try to find out what it is good at. Because mainly marketing departments know that, and they're lying. So you want to get past that sort of, you know, what is it good at? You know, everyone's like, oh, Midjourney, it's going to replace concept artists. Okay, that's what the marketing says. That's what the buzz says, is that it's going to replace, you know, that it says good at concept art. Let's find out what it's not good at. And immediately people are like, hands. I was like, you're right. It's really bad at hands, you know? But you know what it's worse at? Taking direction. You know, like, try and get, you know, Stable Diffusion to give you an image of somebody facing away from camera, you know, from a specific camera angle. You know, it'll put a face in their hair, you know, 90% of the time. So it's not smart.
Yeah, I think understanding what it really is would be probably a good thing. It's as you said, it's sort of this concept of a neural net is not really all that complex. I had to look into it for my last job and dabble with it a little bit. It's fairly straightforward. I think if more people understood what they were, they would know that it's not there. Yeah, there is other AI being developed, as it has been since I had an AI module at university. That was a little while ago now, 25 years or something ago. That we're still not at that point of
no.
What I remember in that was evolutionary computing, where the computer programs and then the fittest one survived, and then like that's still not really shown up in a significant way.
There was a story from decades ago. It wasn't the 50s, but it might have been the 60s or 70s, where they had a software reprogrammable chip that they basically had a program. Basically, they knew the input, an analog signal in, and they knew the analog signal out that they desired, and they basically let the software flip the switches, in the chip to create a circuit that would produce the desired results. And it did so with using less transistors than any human that had that had tried to program it. And there was one, and it only worked on that chip. It didn't work generally on other chips of that design. And there was one transistor that had been flipped that wasn't part of the actual signal flow. And they've realized that it was probably that there was some interference, electrical interference, that just basically, pushed the signal down a slightly different path. And so it was this like black box that this piece of software created, where it solved the problem and it did it differently than any human being had. And there was a mystery piece of magic in it, basically, that nobody could understand really. And they spent analyzing it. And it's like, that's a neural net. It's not smart, but it's clever, I guess, in terms
powerful,
of
powerful, I think.
Powerful. It's slime mold, right? It's slime mold. It'll do what you train it to do, and it'll do it very well and surprisingly well, but that's it.
And not anything else. Yeah. Well, I know we're approaching the end of the podcast. So is there anything that you would, you've got so much that you could have talked about? I would encourage anybody to go check out some of Andy's videos and things about nerfs and Gaussian splatting and all the new cool stuff that you're involved in. But is there anything you'd like to share, anywhere where people can go find out more?
LinkedIn has a link to my website, and it's a little outdated in terms of there's projects in progress that aren't done enough to put them up there. But I've got a VR short film that'll be in Fivers next month up in Canada. I'm furiously finishing the app to play it back. And then have a Nerf project that is arty R&D. It's long exposure Nerfs, basically. So 2 second exposures and bullet time, like cascades and stuff. That will probably be a VR project, hopefully, if we can get the Nerf side working. Working on some Stable Diffusion anime, and just kind of a little scattered right now in a good way.
That's cool. Well, it's a good time to be doing it whilst a lot of other things are on pause. It's a good time to go check out stuff and figure things out, figure out the state of all of these things that I'm sure will keep evolving.
It's go time. If you're a creative, it is go time. Start running. Don't panic. Just run. Make something.
Good advice. Well, Andy, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. It's been a really interesting conversation about some very, very hot topics. But always a pleasure hanging out with you. And I look forward to the next time we can do it.
Ditto. Thank you for having me.
You bet. You bet. Thanks also to our audience. Thanks for asking questions. I threw them in as we went. But thank you guys for participating and being a part of today as well. We will be back again in another 2 weeks for episode 56. You can check us out at becomecgpro.com and in our Facebook group. And for anyone interested, we also, as a school, we have an open day that's happening in 4 hours. So you're very welcome to come and join us in that as well. And we're still taking applications up to the wire. So, yeah. Thanks again, Andy. And
thank you.
Hope you all have a great day out there. Go make some cool stuff and learn about what's going on in the world. We'll see you soon.